All right. Rick had mentioned that in the course of his research, he tries not to do mathematics. I'm glad to tell you, Rick, that I've succeeded admirably. I'm going to be showing, I mean, what I'm here to be able to do here is to try to integrate a lot of what has gone on in the symposium, the show. What I've done is sort of on an artistic plane, and hopefully to give some ideas about what things I've tried to quantify and what things you might be able to take back with you as far as at least characters in computer animation, as to what things I think could be quantified but haven't been yet. What I've been sort of pursuing over the last few years has been what I call in sort of a combination of two words, which is psychology and realism, or psychorealism. It's been my sort of pursuit in the last few years to try to quantify and to try to put into visual terms in animation those things which are in a way intangible, in a way only implied in people's gestures, in their articulations, and in their psychologies. What we've seen so far in computer animation is that it has sort of approached this point of getting visual realism down, particularly in human character animation. We see that the holy grail, as the cliche goes, of creating fake people is just not being achieved. A very quick crash course in that goes back to the 1980s. Rick, you mentioned Fred Park among and Steve DePauly as among other people, as being people who have parameterized human characteristics, human physical characteristics, and brought about some database of how these behaviors, in particular facial animation, as the example I'm giving here, how that database has really informed us about coding systems in human faces, draw on the work of Eklund as well as other people, the facial action coding system, for the way that these faces are modeled in the case of what Fred did back in the 80s and animated you know, with the work of Lance Williams and I just have a mental block right now. Going on, some artists took a lot of that work. Keith Waters is the person I was thinking of, and started to apply it to the art of doing facial animation and character animation, particularly Matt Elson, Pierre LaChapelle, as well as others. And today we've got increasing convergence on actual human realism. Three examples here through digital domain. And life effects. My focus, though, which overlaps with this, but I think goes a little bit beyond it, is can computer animation be used to depict realism of a character's emotional and spiritual state? Those things, the human paradox of psychology combined with spirituality, combined with the physical actions in facial motions and in gestures, anticipation, and follow through, those last two things being sort of canonical rules of traditional animation. What I want to do is to be able to maybe suggest ways in which you look for those things in a somewhat forensic way, in a way that you can analyze, for example, facial tics and gestures. I'm only going to be superficially on this, because we don't have that much time. I would love to be able to talk more, three or more hours on it, but we really have only a few minutes. Psychorealism has been something that has that painters in the last 80 years or so have really known about and have sort of suggested metaphorically what we more literally can do with realism. Picasso here with Guernica, for example, showing some real horror of war through a completely static image. Some more recent examples. This is a painter named Ivan Albright, a Chicago guy, who really showed metaphorically what realistically is only suggested, what visually is only suggested. The painting on the right is called Into the World Came a Soul Called Ida. The model for that is actually 25 years old. And when people looked at that, they actually declared that this was a more realistic version of her than her, you know, photographic visage would have suggested. My favorite artist along these lines is Francis Bacon, English modern painter who really flourished in the 50s and 60s and 70s. That's a self-portrait. That's obviously Francis Bacon on the lower center right here, and that's his self-portrait. That's a friend of his named Isabella Hawthorne, and there's a startling realism, I think, to the painting of her in the upper right. A more recent and more bizarre example of what I would call psychorealism is a painter named Zdzisław Bzeziński, a Polish guy, who takes you know, surrealism and applies a sort of psychological distress to the characters that he depicts in his paintings. It goes way beyond the stylization of, say, somebody like Giger, the guy who, you know, did the alien art direction for the movie Aliens. This person here has, I think, gone beyond that into a very deep and disturbing psychological depiction of his world, which is incredibly detailed and realistic. Okay, move on to sort of an early example of how I was trying some stuff out. Go ahead and press play there, could you please, Jonathan? And we will go to the video. This is the end. This is an animation that I did at Alias Wavefront that Karin was involved with back in 1995. This is an excerpt.
Obscure so that the audience will spend lots of time analyzing them.
So
So the fact that we have no ears, is that another metaphor?
No, submission deadline coming up and I didn't have time to do ears. That's called stylistic streamlining.
Wait, this is totally wrong. I'm not interested in your education. I'm a copy and I'm self-aware. And not only do I have memories of my experiences, I have awareness of my memories of my experiences. If anything, I am creating you. You have no choice but to create this animation, okay? I have free will.
Okay. That's a short excerpt. Okay, one of the things that I was really felt strongly about doing upon the beginning of the production here was to come up with some character profiles for these two folks. These profiles never make it into the animation in any overt way, but they inform the animators, the people who are working on the production, the artists, the modelers, the designers, about, as I mentioned before, intangible things about their appearance, their form, and their delivery. Her, for example, she doesn't have a name, she's just called Her. She's a graduate student in a major Midwest university. She settled in pursuing a degree in modern dance, but has doubts about the academic scene that she's bought into. Her mom has had bouts of depression, was hospitalized once. Dad's been divorced for 5 years from her, lives on the East Coast. She used to see him once a year, but hasn't seen him in a really long time. She can't remember when. She has little or no sexuality at this point in her life. She's not had a serious relationship. She has no desire to have children. And she has an absolute lingering and persistent terror of ever being perceived as being a victim. Okay. I do too. Okay, Tim. He's graduated already. He performs with a modern dance company in a Midwestern city. The pay is terrible, so he's taken on a job at teaching part-time at an art museum. He really has gotten into it. He does children's programming there. Like Her, he's got a sexuality issue. Thinks maybe he's gay, but he's not. He's intimidated by strong women, and therefore he's absolutely terrified of Her. Doesn't show it, but wonders if perhaps it does. Those things never make it into the animation, but they permeate through the characters from the very beginning, or at least I hope they do. Okay, moving on to Bingo. This will require a change of tapes, but that should be simple, right? Yeah, I'm going to show you Bingo. This is a piece that I did at Alias Wavefront 4 years ago now. This was, as a lot of you know, a test bed. Is not only just a short film, it was a test bed to evaluate and to test out and to pound the shit out of the animation software program Maya. But of course, being an animator and an artist, I had my own ulterior motives for doing this. And this is based on a play. It's actually, if you will, a documentary of a play. What we did was we recorded a theater troupe called the Neo-Futurists while they were performing this on stage, and from the audio recording of that performance we created the animation. So the unique thing there is that as I say, it's a documentary. We're recording straight a theater performance as it's happening on stage, and rather than just simply writing a script and getting actors to come in and voice words. So there's this authenticity here that I'm trying to achieve. In addition to that, there's a story in Bingo, which I think is pretty cool, and that's why you've got this garish and I hope imaginative, I hope you would think it's imaginative imagery that goes around it. So let's go ahead and play Bingo, and then I'll talk a little about that. Ah. too many buttons. So just one word about one of the motivations for doing bingo. There was a quote that has bothered me over the last 20 years since I've heard it. It's actually a quote from way before then. Go ahead and about that. The quote is, given the correct circumstances, it is possible to make a man believe that heaven is hell and hell is heaven. The more outrageous the lie, the more likely it is to be believed. That was a quote from Adolf Hitler from Mein Kampf. I've, you know, always been troubled by, you know, first of all, the incredible depraved cynicism of that quote, but also, unfortunately, the accuracy of it through the ages. And one of the themes of Bingo was to try to bring that to light, to expose it in some way or another. Hope it does a little bit of that. But let's go ahead and actually switch to tapes again. This is a little bit of technical acrobatics happening here. Jonathan, you're doing great. So back to the slide presentation. One of the things about that we've touched upon, and Rick certainly touched upon this very well, was are the subtleties of facial animation and acting in particular. I say acting rather than animation, because from an artist, from an animator's point of view, whether the motion comes from keyframing or from motion capture or from any kind of text-to-phoneme based procedure, it still comes down to acting and how much it, the animator or the person who's the intermediary to what goes on the screen, animator or whatever, whoever, knows that that is a performance, and it's the really the performance and the psychology behind the performance that is really the driving and important thing here. So I've got a couple of examples of some really cool, nuanced examples of this. I could have chosen anything from a number of great acting performances that show this, but these a couple of examples show some subtleties that I want to just touch upon for a couple of minutes here. Go ahead and play the first one there. Actually, fast forward through this because this was just keep fast. Just go ahead and fast forward. Keep going. Okay, right. Come back here a second. Okay, stop it right there. No, sorry. Rewind it, please, Jonathan. Okay, keep rewinding. Keep going. Stop. Great. First performance. Stop. No, bring it back. Okay. First performance is Dustin Hoffman and Dennis Franz in the movie American Buffalo. Just to set up the, I don't know how many of you have seen it, probably most of you haven't. Great movie, great acting performance in it. The context in the content of the movie at this point is that the character Teach, which is Dustin Hoffman, has come up with this elaborate plot in order to steal back this object, which is a valuable buffalo nickel from a friend of a friend's house, the friend being Dennis Franz. Dennis Franz is in a car with him, as you see. Dustin Hoffman asks a rhetorical question. He thinks it's rhetorical, like he's got this airtight scheme. Dennis Franz comes back with an answer which is completely unexpected on the part of Dustin Hoffman, Teach. Dustin Hoffman, at that point, his entire world, as far as his plan goes here, is shattered, completely shattered. But he puts on a brave face, and you don't see much of anything happen with, you know, how he responds to this. Dennis Franz says, "My wallet." That is the answer that throws Teach completely off guard. Teach does something which, to Dennis, doesn't look like much of anything, but to the audience, who already knows that his world is shattered at that one moment, he does one thing in particular. So let's play this now. So, what did he do there? For about a quarter of a second, he looked away, And he didn't even look that far away. He looked perhaps 5 degrees of arc away from Dennis Franz and then came right back to him. I'll just play that one second bit again. There. If you were to try to put in some kind of procedural technique for showing how a person has completely lost their base of confidence, you would have something that would take the eye motion of that person, that character, and put a random number generator on it, just so that the eyes dart away and then back. One of the things that we did with Bingo, and that you've noticed if you look through it again, is that the eye motions of the characters are quite different from each other. Pinhead, the person who comes and says, hi, Bingo, first of all. If you look, you know, at the animation, you'll see that his gaze is absolutely unflinching. It's almost dreamy, the way that the eyes, the actual angular rotation of the eyes is something like this. If this were a ball representing the eyeball, it would be something like this. In which he'd be looking like straight at a hole, you know, in whoever's, like Dave's forehead, Dave the seated character. The eyes would be kind of looking around this sort of figure eight pattern about right here. Generally, when people are in a kind of a sleepy or beta state, when they are in conversation with someone, they will actually, their eyes will create something of a figure eight pattern right in the forehead right there. Dave, on the other hand, the seated character, his eyes do what the Dustin Hoffman character did there. His eyes dart. They don't quite make eye contact with the people he talks to. They dart approximately plus or minus 5 degrees away from the person's center of the forehead. And they do it in a motion. Again, if this were the eyeball here, it'd be something like boom, 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 boom. Something like 5 or 6 different darts per second, which is basically almost, you could say, a procedural way of Dave demonstrating his complete lack of grounding in the moment there. Okay, so here's just one example of extreme, I think, subtle facial performance. Here's another one from the movie American Beauty. This is the famous "There's so much beauty in the world" part of it. So I'll play that, and I'm going to try to concentrate on one still frame here. And let's go. I'm going to try to rewind this just to the point where he says, "in my heart." Okay. Try again. Here we go. He says, "and my heart," and what you see there is that he's smiling very slightly. What he's conveying, what Wes Bentley, the actor, does a very good job of conveying, is that he's just full of emotion, much of which is conflicting. He's on the verge of either this joyful laugh, or he's on the verge of breaking into tears at this point. What's happening actually with his facial performance, this is actually a couple of frames after what I was going to show, but there's a little bit of what I was going to show anyway. You know, when you think of somebody smiling, when you think of the stereotype of a smiling face, it's always, you know, this concave, you know, lips going up like that, right? What you're seeing there is he's clearly smiling, right? But he's not doing that kind of concave lip thing there that is so stereotypical of being happy. What's happening with Mr. Bentley's facial muscles at that point is that there's a conflict occurring. Eklund talks a little bit about this in the facial action coding system. There's a set of muscles called the zygomatic major muscles that pull up on the face, and you get a smile as a result of that. On the other hand, when you frown, there's a whole bunch of set of muscles down here that are pulling down on the face. The triangularis muscles, the risorius and platysma muscles, the mentalis muscle, which is pushing up. So when you're in the kind of conflict that Wes Bentley is at this very instant experiencing, you're getting a muscular conflict as well. The zygomatics are pulling up at the same time that the triangularis muscles are pulling down and the mentalis is pushing up the middle of the lips. And you get what, you know, we read as a faint smile, but you're not getting that concave appearance in his lips. You're getting something that's much more ambiguous, and the reason it's ambiguous, and Wes Bentley knows this from being able to act it out, is a conflict in the muscles that manifests a conflict in his emotions. So I try to tell animators who work with me on stuff that this kind of subtlety is what we're after. I mean, so often in, you know, the way that animation is generally taught in computer graphics, computer animation is very much along a traditional approach, the Disney approach, which is, with the Disney approach, you have what are called the 12 rules of animation, which come out of a book, very canonical book, called The Illusion of Life by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson. One of the things that they emphasize is, for one of the rules is called exaggeration, where you're supposed to take, you know, basic either acting nuances or facial nuances and to exaggerate them by a certain amount and follow through with them. What I'm trying to show here and what I teach to animators is that you need to have an additional rule to temper that, which is what you would call restraint. Wes Bentley does that incredibly well here, and in restraining his performance, he's able to show that muscular conflict, which shows a very deep emotional conflict happening under that at that precise moment right there. Go ahead and just press play again. I'll just show just a couple of examples that I did a couple of years ago when I did some consulting work with Nelvana. So we actually used those acting snippets on a little character here, whose name is Carl. So it's a different performance than Wes Bentley's performance, but one of the things I was trying to do was that thing right there, in which he's got a kind of a smile happening, but that muscle press on the corners of the lips manifest themselves as well. This is another example. One of the people at Nelvana did this. He also put in a little bit of a smile at the wrong time there. I mean, wrong in terms of when you're supposed to smile, but in this case, it was the right time. It was one that gave a really sarcastic bent to the acting performance in that one in that 15 seconds of animation right there. Okay, so I just want to talk about what I'm working on right now, which is I'm working on an animated documentary, which I'll get to in a couple of minutes, but just to give some context here. Animated documentaries are a relatively new form in animation and a non-existent form in computer animation, at least up until now. There's a body of work out there, which I'm showing a couple of examples of here. How many of you have seen Creature Comforts? A good fair number of you have seen it. It was an Academy Award-winning animated short film from Aardman Studios, Nick Park, from 12 years ago, in which Nick Park recorded people coming out of the zoo, the London Zoo, and just asked them to talk about their lives. And he took the audio from those rather mundane conversations and he turned them into animal creatures. And the creatures then manifest in a very literal sense what these people were talking about in a somewhat more metaphorical sense. Repetition Compulsion is by a great filmmaker in Boston named Ellie Lee, who interviewed people from a battered homeless woman shelter talking about their abusive relationships. It's a rather horrifying film in that it's not very sentimental at all, and it shows a lot of interpreted and very graphical imagery of what these women are talking about. Snack and Drink, the thing on the bottom, is pretty interesting. Bob Sabeson and Tony Pallotta were the art directors on a film called Waking Life that came out last year. What they did here was to use this very dreamy, floaty, rotoscopy animation technique to try to recreate the world of an autistic teenager who lives in Austin, Texas. The guy's about 12 years old, and he talks rather articulately for being really autistic. And they take that and they turn it into this thing that's at the same time simultaneously colorful, garish, and nightmarish, and very whimsical. Elements of animated documentaries, if I may go back to that. Unscripted dialogue, which I'm, you know, as far as getting something to, I mean, as far as being able to quantify how people actually talk and how they anticipate and how they voice phonemes and how they follow through with head motions, etc., you can't beat being able to record people actually delivering their lines without any script. Things like ums and you knows and stutters, which don't make it into acting performances, make it into this stuff. And it's material that I find absolutely bottomless as far as what you can mine for a really great drama. Free ambience, things like car horns, street noises, etc. And the most important for me, allegorical and interpretive imagery. That is, I think there's a lot of power in being able to take relatively mundane dialogue and turning it into something which I, the animator, the artist as the god here, can turn into something that is more powerful than just simply doing live action. The thing I'm working on right now is a film called Ryan, a 12-minute animated short film. I'm working with it appears that I will be soon working with the National Film Board of Canada on this. It's a sort of an impromptu studio that is up at Seneca College. I'm pleased to say that Karan Singh and Patrick Coleman are both working with me on various elements of this. This is going to be, I think, is the first CG example of the animated documentary techniques that I just mentioned, being, you know, put into what I hope will be a pretty dramatic story of this person whose name is Ryan Larkin, to be particular. Have any of you ever heard of Ryan Larkin? Ryan Larkin, a friend of mine, as I said, he's 60 years old now. He lives in Montreal. He's homeless. He begs for spare change at the corner of Saint Laurent and Napoleon in the Maine in Montreal, right by a restaurant called Schwartz's. He's in bad health and he's an alcoholic, but he's also a pretty amazing guy because, well, amongst other things, because 30 years ago, he was the most famous animator in Canada. He was an Academy Award nominee for a film called Walking, which he did in 1968. Numerous awards, accolades, lots and lots and lots of exposure at the time. He was, for a brief period of time in the late 60s, Canada's most famous and most colorful independent filmmaker. He was at the National Film Board. He was a protege of Norman McLaren, and people kind of just expected that he was going to be the sort of shining star of Canadian film, you know, at least experimental Canadian filmmaker at that time. How he got from where he was then to where he is now is the story that I'm trying to tell in this documentary. What I'm doing is I've in several occasions gone to Montreal and recorded dialogue, audio dialogue with Ryan in order to make an allegorical story out of it. This is what Ryan was like in the 60s when he was a superstar at the National Film Board. This is what he looks like today. What you're seeing in the upper picture here and this picture over here are photographs of a studio shoot where I basically sat down with him. We had some nice microphones put on us, and we recorded in, you know, fairly high fidelity about an entire day's worth of conversation. It was very dramatic in many ways. He became very emotional about his life on two or three occasions, and naturally we're going to be using that in the animation. I can't show you too much for it because we're still in the beginning stages of it, but I'm going to show you a few CG stills and some concept sketches. This is these are some early concept sketches. That is what I sort of envisioned Ryan looking like in this sort of psycho-realistic manner. This is these are some early busts of Ryan and the interviewer, who bears a strong resemblance to myself. So there's a, you know, both of these characters together sort of embody how I look at a lot of where my work is going right now, which is a quote by Anais Nin: "We don't see things as they are; we see things as we are." Now I'm going to show just a couple of get out of this mode. A few test animations and images of the work that we've done so far. You'll have to wait for a second while this while the computer sort of burps this up. So as I said, I've worked with Karen and Patrick on creating the look and the set in which these characters will find themselves in. Karin has done a lot of work with perspective distortion, and we use that actually in the main set in which the characters hang out. That's what you see here. Patrick will show a little bit more of this later. So what we're doing here, this is a cafeteria in a homeless men's shelter. What we're doing in an extreme way is taking various elements of the cafeteria and distorting them in a very procedural way. The way, and I'm sure that Patrick will be able to talk a little bit more in depth about this, but what we do is to take a single camera and to modify various elements of perspective with by the use of these, what we call lackey cams, that will change vanishing points basically go between 2 and 3 point perspective at the animator's control. Notice, for example, the back wall. The vanishing point from that actually goes from being up here to going down here within the space of about 5 seconds. The effect here is sort of a bit among the expressionistic lines of a movie like a silent movie called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I'm trying to get a disorienting, but only slightly, subtly disorienting feel to the space that these characters hang out in. Here is Ryan as I've modeled him up to this point. Okay. Come back, Ryan. So this is Ryan Larkin as I have envisioned him in this documentary. You're going to have to listen closely. Let's try that again, eh?
But no, they stopped me from
That's one of the characters. Here's a facial animation test on the other character, the other main character.
We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are.
Okay. So we have several characters who have who speak like this, and currently we are using a combination of keyframing and a little bit of motion capture, or we expect to be using some motion capture that that will be at, set up at our studio, we think, in the next 3 months. But the facial animation performance you see there right now is entirely keyframed. I would love to be able to proceduralize some of that. I mean, right now, what we are having to do is to, in a quantifying way, look at the facial performance of someone like Ryan and not copy it, but to glean the elements of it from him and other characters. For example, in that segment you see there, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Ryan is already quite drunk when he's saying that line to me. He says, "They stopped me. They stopped me from making those freeform films." One of the things that happens when people are drunk is that their facial muscles, particularly in the lower part of their face, become very relaxed. And in fact, in the case of Ryan, so relaxed that his lower lip begins to droop. It actually begins to behave. Actually begins to succumb to gravity. So the facial performance there does have, some gravity on his lip, and we have the animator has to fight it in order to bring it, back up in order to make what you would call the vocal fricative of free-form films. So it's that kind of stuff that kind of detail that I would love to be able to proceduralize, but right now it's just an artistic endeavor. Just a couple of other, let me bring back that folder here, just to show a couple of other examples of sets that we have designed. Okay. Here's a full body animation of Chris saying that, the character Chris saying the line that you just heard uttered.
We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are.
Okay. Here's the other set that we'll be using for a lot of where the action takes place. This is just an ordinary, grody, gritty-looking bathroom. And we're looking at it in a very early stage of development. This will eventually be subject to the same distortion perspective that I had mentioned before. Okay, I'm pretty much at the end of my talk at this point. This project is going to take about 8 months of further production to do. We hope to be premiering it sometime in the late autumn next year. And that's it. If you have any questions, I'd love to hear them. Thanks. Well, people in this animation field who know me would tell you that I think too much in terms of the forensics of a face. When I try to teach this stuff to people, they tend to want to be much more right-brained about, well, it's just the performance that really counts here. I tend to be very much an anatomy glutton. I would say, recently, I've come to really see things in terms of in terms of facial musculature, just kind of a fetish of mine. For example, eyebrows. I mean, I tend to lock onto eyebrows and think, oh, yes, the frontalis muscle is acting up a little bit on that person, you know, whatever. But that's just me. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes. Yeah.
Have just like an egg with two big eyes.
Yeah.
With so little, so few degrees of freedom, they achieve so much expressivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you can draw a connection, but it's a completely big part to achieve the same level of emotion with all these features. And the same level of emotion, but with a huge amount of features.
Well, you're talking about one end of the spectrum, and I'll give another end that in just a sec. But one thing that brings up is the difference there is between realism on one hand and believability on the other hand. They're not one and the same by any means. Those birds, you know, he's talking about For the Birds, which is an animated short that came out a couple of years ago, which is very cartoony, and the birds. Bird characters in it are, you know, they have very expressive eyes and they're very funny. It's a very hilarious animated short. But they do them through the most simple of gestures. The eyes are mere spheres, you know, the eyelid comes down, comes up, you know, like a window shade on these characters. And yeah, they do things that show that they're annoyed, that they're happy, that they're arrogant little birds, which they are in that. it comes across without unmistakably, and you know, this is a tradition that animators have built upon for the last, I mentioned, ballpark 80 years since Steamboat Willie, you know, Walt Disney's first Mickey Mouse thing back in the mid-20s. On the other hand of that spectrum, is where you have realism, but you don't necessarily have those gestures built into a character. And I think particularly of Japanese tradition of no masks, you know, in which theater is taking place with these highly, often very highly detailed masks that these characters or these actors will wear, but these masks are incapable, because they're rigid, incapable of any expression whatsoever. But the expression is brought about by context, you know, by facial tics, but very importantly, in addition to that, by light. You know, that light shining from above gives a sad or a menaced look to the characters. Light shifting from below gives an entirely different expression on the characters. So, you know, on one hand, you've got For the Birds, which shows how you can use rules like the 12 rules of animation that I mentioned, you know, to create nuance, things like exaggeration, follow-through, anticipation, and so on. And on the other hand, with no, which is also interesting to me, through restraint, through context, through complexity of the performance suggesting what the facial expression is. There's a little bit of both of that. I'm sort of in the point where I'm trying to emphasize the restraint part of things in the stuff that I'm doing. Yeah.
One of the differences between the theater or musicians or music and animation is that in the practice stages, for music, for example, you can have this very mechanistic view and think about the forensics of what you're doing. Then you have the opportunity for performing where you can, in some sense, blank out, let it all just some unconscious swirl of stuff pump it out and hope that all the hours that have been spent analyzing will get synthesized on some other level.
Yeah.
Some sort of a parallel moment or experience that you find with animation where you can, all this analysis that you've had, that you've been doing, can get synthesized without the analytic process, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, imagine this. You're an animator. working on a production like this. You have a very real deadline of 3.5 weeks, and you have still 3 minutes of animation to pump out. You are frantic. You're not even in an intellectual mode at this point. You are in a point of complete transcendent stress. You are doing this stuff without thinking. You are doing facial stuff, in this case, focusing on, without any intellectual process other than the intellectual stuff that you've been training yourself on through the production up to this point. Yeah, I've been. That's what I went through. That's what animators worked with me went through on the productions I've shown you thus far. It's not intellectual at that point. It's entirely instinctual. And you can analyze it after the fact as to how well it worked, but at the time, it's just you're performing. And it's just that you hope for the best, as I'm paraphrasing you.
And so, given that happened, when you look back, you still think that what happened there could be captured entirely procedurally?
I would like a lot of it to be, or I mean, some of... I would like a lot of the background stuff to be captured procedurally. For example, just having a character stand still right now, if you do it with keyframing, requires almost as much effort as to make the character start doing, flips in the air. A character standing there like this, there's breathing going on, there are these head ticky things going on, and so on. If you were to start from scratch and keyframe that, without doing some procedural stuff, it's very time consuming. I mean, it's more than worthwhile. It's absolutely essential. If a character is not doing that, he looks creepy. But nonetheless, that is an example that comes to mind as to what can be proceduralized to some extent. When I say, I'm looking at you right now, I think that I'm looking straight at you. As opposed to my character Dave, who, if he were looking at you, he'd be like, his eyes would be all over the place. Being able to, in a sense, proceduralize that those elements of personality are really important. The kinds of actions that Dave and Bingo does is much more twitchy. Like he's a twitching piece of meat, basically. When he points at himself, he has a very quick ease in and a very, very slow ease out of his motions, bump, like that, as opposed to someone like the clown character, where his eases ins are slow, and they stay slow into his easing out, with the animated terms, but I think you know what I mean, right? Being able to say this person, has this complex psychology that makes him nervous when clowns come around him, would manifest itself in fast ease-ins and slow ease-outs, for example. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to make sense of that. Using expressions to convey something other than simply the expression of the character. They use it to convey something else? Something... Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if this is an example that comes close to answering your question, but I mean, in a completely analytical use of facial expressions, it has been suggested, I don't know if you've ever heard of Chernoff faces, using facial expressions to visualize data sets, basically. That is, that we are so attuned to, as human beings, to subtleties in facial expression. This guy Chernoff, back in the early 70s, you know, came up with this notion, you know, what if you parlayed that extreme sensitivity we have to facial expressions and used that in order to convey complex data sets. And that goes beyond simply using facial expression in a way that in a way that just conveys the emotional state of or the psychological state of the character. The examples that I've seen of that have looked very creepy. I mean, it being that, you know, facial expression is something that is so tied to our common experiences of who people are, that to go beyond that into something more abstract, like, say, representing data sets, really sort of goes against the grain of what expressions are there in the first place for, at least as far as, you know, what we are as animals hardwired to use them for. I'm sort of trying to skirt around your question, but I'm trying to answer as best as I can. Does that come anywhere near? Okay. Yeah. Oh, by the way, this is Robin Barger. Robin is a... I'm going to do that. Because I like to pick on you, man. Robin worked with me on The End. He was the sound and composer and co-writer on The End. So you've got the floor now, Robin. Say whatever you want. I would say that any such solution to what I think you're looking for would, in one way or another, involve a random number generator. One of the things that in animation that I get annoyed with is that animators too often insist on announcing what the character is thinking or what the character is doing some interval of around a half a second to a full second in advance of what actually happens. It's like the animator tries to make clear that there is some obvious in the acting world intent, motivation for every action that happens in the character. We're a lot more complex than that, and the random number generator comes into effect when a person does, just in the normal course of day-to-day acting, performing, moving around, does something that is entirely contradictory to what the previous action was. It's what makes us human. It's those nuances that from one person to another and from one moment to another on the same person creates that contradictory set of actions that is very much human nature. Down the road we will have, I'm sure, some artificial intelligence-based generator of characters. The work that I've seen thus far, I think most of you will agree on that, has been woeful. Researchers that I've seen at SIGGRAPH and elsewhere are largely on the right track on that. But there is a random element to performances that is missing right now, both in the work that a lot of animators do and in more of the procedural results that I've seen from human, from automated human character animation. Is that, again, I'm not sure I've answered the question, but it was a pretty broad question. It was a question. What are you talking about? Well, I mean, not necessarily more subtle. What the example that you give, if I understand it right, is that the robot is looking at what it's doing in order to correct a state which that robot had been in, which was a more uncertain state, trying to lock gaze with something in order to bring more certainty to that robot's motions. Uncertainty is one of the more vulnerable states of human beings, and when a person, for example, makes eye contact with the person that he or she's engaging with, if that eye contact comes at the wrong moment, that person betrays a lot of insecurity. Like, we're not that far off from what you're describing and what I've been trying to describe here. Yeah. what Wes Bentley can do with those little balls on his face and on his elbows and stuff is to give Wes Bentley performance. And in and more general, he can give a performance of a a young guy in his mid to late 20s who's got a certain acting range. I mean, that's great. But if you ever needed to go beyond that performance, if the animator ever needed to go beyond that performance of Wes Bentley, the animator would have a very difficult time. And in fact, the animator would be back to square one doing what he or she does best often, which is just keyframing. What animation brings to the table that live action doesn't is, the things that Disney has known about, or, the entity Disney has known about for 80 years, which are those elements of animation that I've talked about a little bit here, exaggeration, and anticipation, things that give a character the ability to rudimentalize or to simplify, things that Wes Bentley could never do. Putting markers on Wes Bentley would be great for getting a literal performance of that character or that person, but I've not seen it go beyond that. Motion capture is a great tool for simplifying and streamlining the animation process when you are doing realistic animation and not that much else, at least at this point in the planology. It gets along the lines of what I was talking about before, where you proceduralize, just say somebody standing still like this, getting in the case of Wes Bentley, it would be great to get the Wes Bentley tics, the way that he might twitch his knee as he's talking there, the way that he might scratch his face inadvertently. To get that kind of base low-level behavior is, I'm just speaking off the cuff here as to where I would like to use motion capture, is to get that rudimentary behavior down and then to build on it using the creativity that I've got or my staff of animators has got as artists.